Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome. This is MoneyWeb at Midday. Whether you're tuning in live or listening to the podcast, please join me, Jeremy Mags, as I explore the issues and ideas shaping our world with key thinkers and decision makers. So let's get started, sharp, relevant, and straight to the heart of the story. Coming up on the program today, the Home Affairs Minister's Trusted Tour Operators scheme starts bearing fruit, the Department of Health responding to unplaced junior doctors' legal threats, how a trade-phobic Trump presidency will influence South Africa, and please think twice before you take another sip of that soda. We'll find out what sugary drinks are costing the local health sector and the economy. It's Tuesday, the 14th of January. Now, I think it's common cause that South Africa's tourism sector has been struggling to recover fully, with visa delays and administrative efficiencies often cited as barriers to growth. Now, in an attempt to address this, the Department of Home Affairs launching the Trusted Tour Operators scheme. It's aimed at streamlining visa applications from tourists, particularly from China and India. But here's my question: is this initiative enough to revitalize the sector and ensure that South Africa remains competitive as a destination? I'm in conversation now with Dr. Leon Schreiber, the Minister of Home Affairs. Dr. Schreiber, welcome. Thank you very much indeed for joining me. The scheme promises efficiency, but visa backlogs and delays, I don't need to tell you, have plagued Home Affairs for years. How is this scheme going to avoid falling into the same pattern of inefficiency?
Yeah, good afternoon, Jeremy, and to your listeners. Well, I think firstly, the point to make is this is exactly why it's so important that we cleared the visa backlog during the course of last year, precisely so that we can get back on the front foot and not be dealing with applications in that particular backlog, which had gone back a decade in some cases. So firstly, we're starting from a much cleaner sheet than we have for many years in Home Affairs. I think the second point is, of course, precisely through the lessons that we've learned on the backlog project and the success of dealing with those 306,000 applications, we will now take a similar project management approach to the adjudication for the Trusted Tour Operator scheme to make sure that we've got dedicated people working to process these particular applications. One of the beauties of this particular project, and to answer your biggest question that you've asked right at the start, no, it's in and of itself not going to be the full picture, but it is a very important step on the road to fully exploiting South Africa's tourism potential, because it is going to adopt a risk-sharing model with the tour operators themselves. So these tour operators, 65 of them that we've selected from China, India, and South Africa, will be signing agreements with the Department of Home Affairs where they will be held liable if there's misconduct by the clients that they bring over. And in exchange for that, we're going to be dropping some of the red tape, dealing with the language barriers, and indeed ensuring that we can bring more tourists from these two major source markets to South Africa.
And Minister, you're confident in that vetting process, because the last thing that you want is potential exploitation or fraud by those tour operators that have been included in the program.
Yes, of course. And we take a leaf here from the Trusted Employer Scheme, which is something that has been running within the department for a couple of years now, with real success and real lessons for us. So in the Trusted Employer Scheme, what we have there is essentially the same model, where big corporate employers in South Africa who need skills have entered into the same risk-sharing model. And that has worked very effectively to make sure that big companies actually are able to hire the people they need to grow. So we're using exactly the same model to now transpose that into the tourism space, where we will share those risks. Look, the point is, Jeremy, now at least in this space, we know who to hold liable. We know we can monitor much more closely through the companies what's going on with the clients and with these tourists. So yes, I'm confident that we are certainly moving in the right direction. But as you say, it's certainly not the end of the road.
Why have you limited this to just China and India? My question is, are we not risking alienating other key tourism markets that could bring in significant revenue?
So it's important to keep in mind, obviously, that there are many countries that are visa-exempt tourists who come to South Africa. So if you think about the US, large parts of Europe, those people don't need a visa prior to arrival in South Africa, and that will not change. So the real problem sits with those countries that are not visa-exempt, and among those are the two biggest markets here. Just to give you an idea, China in 2023 had over 100 million outbound travelers, and South Africa only got 93,000 of those tourists, in many cases because of precisely the difficulty of getting the visa issue sorted. So I think we're starting with the two biggest ones, the ones that will have a major and immediate impact. But I do want to make one other really important point. I hope that if we get our digital transformation work right, that even the Trusted Tour Operator Scheme, as well as the Trusted Employer Scheme, are ultimately interim measures that we are putting in place because we've got an immediate problem of getting skills and tourists into the country. But what we really want to do, even as we operate these schemes to address those immediate needs, is to make sure that we create the modern digital interfaces that you can see in many other countries now, including Kenya and the Seychelles here in Africa, where tourists can go online. They can go onto a platform. You're using modern technology to adjudicate those visas in a secure and very efficient manner, and that you actually don't need to have any kind of human interaction except where there are those exceptional cases. So that's where we want to end up. But we can't sit back in the meantime and not do anything about South Africa underperforming in, you know, the skills that it requires or the tourism that we can actually get as a country.
As far as this particular scheme is concerned, you will have plans in place, no doubt, to address complaints or bottlenecks, particularly during the initial phases, to ensure that it doesn't damage our already fragile reputation as a tourist destination.
Yeah, and I think the biggest one to point to right now is, again, the capacity and the experience and the progress that we've achieved through the backlog project. I was saying last year, all throughout of last year, that the backlog project doesn't matter only in and of itself in Home Affairs. Dealing with those 306,000 applications that had been stuck for so long was also important because it shows us how we can be more efficient going forward. And now being able to use the same people, the same resources, the same lessons that we had, and moving that into this new space, because the backlog, thankfully, is not what it used to be, we do have those resources now to plug them into the Trusted Tour Operator Scheme. The best thing would be, of course, to prevent the bottlenecks. And really, as I say, Jeremy, at the end of the day, the way in which you really have a system that's flawless is by embracing technology and introducing things like your electronic travel authorizations that you get for a country like Kenya. We're working on getting there, but in the meantime, we're going to use the experience and the lessons from the backlog project to also now help out in this particular space.
And I think you've partially answered the next question, but the broader visa system, Minister, still does face severe criticism. So this TTOS, is it a cosmetic solution to a more systemic problem within Home Affairs, do you think?
No, I think it's part of the systemic solution, but it isn't the sum total of what we need to do by any stretch of the imagination. So look, what we did last year in the skills space is, of course, to change the regulatory environment. We've introduced the points-based system for work visas, and we've really reformed the way in which skills are attracted to South Africa. Now we're trying to do the same in the tourism space. This is also a regulatory change to enable these companies to actually work with us in this way. And so we're progressing down this road. But ultimately, both for skills and tourism, we want to bring in technology to really unlock where we want to end up. So yes, it's not cosmetic by any stretch, but it's also certainly another step down the road rather than reaching the end destination.
And just a quick one, obviously security concerns always raised with visa reform. You mentioned that these operators have been closely vetted, but there's always the difficulty of balancing national security with greater accessibility, isn't there?
Yes, and I think that balancing act is really fundamental to what we need to do in Home Affairs. And, you know, you need to be a risk manager in this space. You can't be a gatekeeper whose job it is to just keep everyone out because then investment, tourism and the economy collapses. But at the same time, you need to be able to differentiate those people that pose a risk to the country and its security. So that's why I'm really grateful that we've worked throughout this process with the State Security Agency, Minister Ntshavheni, as well as the Minister of Tourism, Minister De Lille, to make sure we get as many of those eyes and perspectives on this process. And of course, Jeremy, as with anything, if something does go wrong, it is incumbent upon us that we fix it and act quickly. There's, you know, that is something that we must always be alive to. But I think the way we've approached this, including through our use of artificial technology, artificial intelligence in the vetting process, it sets us up to get it as right as we can. And we know that things can't be fixed overnight. There is no magic wand, as I've said many times before. But I really think that we are on the right track, and that hopefully, if we're talking a few months down the line, we'll start to see those numbers of tourists from China and India increasing. And that'll also give us the confidence that we actually can fix the things that are important to growing the South African economy and creating jobs.
And Minister, I'll let you go and issue that exit visa to your dog. Thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Minister of Home Affairs, Dr. Leon Schreiber.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
As we reported yesterday, South Africa's healthcare system is under fire again. Something in the region of 1,800 junior doctors nationwide say they're unable to secure employment after completing their community service. And the crisis, they tell me, is highlighted by the Eastern Cape's announcement that it cannot provide jobs for these medical professionals in spite of severe shortages of doctors in that particular province. The South African Medical Association says this is unacceptable and is pushing for urgent action, warning, it says, of far-reaching consequences for both the healthcare system and patient care. Well, right of reply now, we spoke to the Junior Doctors Association yesterday. I'm in conversation now with Foster Mohale, who speaks for the National Health Department. Foster, thank you very much indeed. So first of all then, how does the department justify leaving over 1,800 junior doctors unemployed while provinces are reporting critical shortages of doctors?
Yes, as the Department of Health, we are doing everything possible to recruit as many medical doctors and other health professionals as possible. The only limitation that we have is budgetary constraints.
Could you give me a sense of how bad those budget constraints are and what you're doing to try and rectify it?
As you know that in the past few years, our budgets have been shrinking in terms of allocations, but not only for the Department of Health, but across the public sector. But we've been presenting our case as the Department of Health through the National Treasury just to show them the impact of budget cuts on our ability to provide quality health service in order to ensure that people don't wait long queues, long waiting times for surgeries, so that we're able to recruit as many health professionals as possible. So, and we continue to do that. We do that almost every year. We present our case so that the National Treasury, when they do allocations, they can look at our case differently from other departments. Of course, that doesn't mean other departments are not equally important as the Department of Health.
But it would seem the Treasury is not listening to you because people are still waiting in long lines, and the allegation is that healthcare is now being severely compromised.
Look, we understand the impact of this, but look, we do everything possible. As we even go to an extent where we go and repurpose some of posts which were not originally designed for medical doctors, but for other professions, in order to accommodate as many doctors as possible. But we can do up to a certain extent in order to create as many posts for medical doctors and other health professionals as possible. So, and we'll continue to engage with the National Treasury so that we are able to reduce the impact of this number of unemployed doctors.
You'll be well aware that the South African Medical Association now is threatening legal action if this issue is not resolved quickly. What's your department's response to this challenge?
We understand the concerns and the threats by all the concerned groups and also individuals and families. But as government, as I indicated, that we will continue in our, we have got the open door policy. We do have engagements with all the stakeholders, including the unions and organizations of healthcare workers in different categories. They do have discussions with the department so that we're able to present our case to, so that they can see that we are not just sitting, but we are doing everything possible. So we've got good working relations with them. That's why from time to time we engage them to say, please, this is our challenges. Please try to see where you can be able to assist in terms of suggestions on how we can be able to overcome some of these challenges. We understand their concerns, challenges, but we'll continue to engage them so that they understand the situation.
It's difficult to imagine that you've got a good working relationship with the various stakeholders, given that this might end up in court.
Yeah, no, this, remember, they represent the interests of their members and their members and their future members, the doctors. So we also try by all means to ensure that the doctors and other healthcare workers, they work in a conducive environment. They don't have to work long hours. They don't have to serve more patients than they're supposed to serve as per the ratio. But unfortunately, the current situation dictates that we need to find ways to address this situation. Of course, this is not a project, it's a process. We'll continue to update them with the progress that we make as far as mobilizing more resources to recruit more healthcare workers.
Is there any indication then in that respect that Treasury is going to accede to your request for more money come budget time?
We previously they did allocate additional resources, and we believe that because they equally understand the role of the departments in providing a long and healthy life for all South Africans. So, and also for the economy to grow, they need a healthy workforce. So we strongly believe that they are taking our requests into consideration. So maybe we'll wait until the budget vote. Probably the finance minister might be able to add a few more rents and cents on our budget.
How does the department respond to claims from the SA Medical Association that this particular situation is a broader failure of healthcare planning and resource allocation?
Look, I beg to differ because, as I indicated, that we are open for discussions. They know our positions in terms of the financial resources. It's not about the failure, but the limited resources, and the current issue of budget cuts affects all the departments, not only the Department of Health, the Department of Education to appoint, recruit more teachers, build more schools, the Department of Social Development. So it cuts across all the public sector. Of course, as health, we feel that this has got a huge impact, especially because of the service that we are providing to the general public with regards to quality healthcare.
I'm going to leave it there. Foster Mahali, thank you very much indeed. Speaks for the Department of Health.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at midday.
Donald Trump's return to the White House has sent shockwaves across the globe with his second presidency, expected to bring sweeping changes to U.S. foreign policy. As far as South Africa is concerned, it presents significant challenges, particularly in navigating trade relations, geopolitical alliances, and the potential fallout from his administration's stance on multilateral institutions. I want to unpack this a little further and what all of this could mean for South Africa. We're joined by Peter Fabricius, who writes on international relations and U.S. Africa diplomacy. Peter, welcome and thank you. So what immediate changes, if any, do you anticipate in US-South Africa relations under the second presidency?
Yeah, look, I'm not so sure about immediate changes. What we have to see is just how Trump's kind of aversion to free trade might impact us, particularly through AGOA, you know, the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, which gives us duty-free access to the U.S. market, as you know. So there's some unknowns here, and that is what Trump himself thinks, because he's a sort of unknown quantity, unpredictable, and then also how the two houses of Congress, both now in Republican hands, will respond to his kind of pressure, whichever it might, you know, way it might go, you know.
Mm. But we have to be aware that his administration's America First policy is going to drive all decisions.
Yeah, so one can deduce from that that he's probably not very favorably disposed to a go, for example. I guess the only thing one can hope for maybe is that it's just de minimis, you know, minibus. It might just not fall under his attention, being too small to matter compared to the gigantic battles he seems to be girding himself against China and Mexico and Canada and so on. You know?
But Peter, given that Donald Trump has a focus on bilateral trade deals, do you think that we have any leverage to negotiate favorable terms with the United States, or is it too early to call that?
He does prefer bilaterals, but you know, there's an issue with bilateral trade with the U.S., you know, Trump notwithstanding. They've tried some time ago to do that, years ago, 10 years ago, and those negotiations just failed, you know, and partially because I think the U.S. has certain kind of requirements that it insists on every trade deal, and SADC, as it was, or SACU, South African Customs Union, wasn't up to that. So I don't see that's something he might prefer to, because it would be a reciprocal deal, obviously, that would come out of it. But I can't see that happening during his term anyway.
And he's also, as we well know, been vocal in his criticism of multilateral organizations. Surely this means something for South Africa when it comes to our participation in bodies like the United Nations and the WTO. Again, we need to be wary of this.
Yeah, exactly. He's not a multilateralist, and South Africa is very much a multilateral country in its foreign policy philosophy, at least. And of course, BRICS. I don't know, maybe you're going to get to BRICS as another multilateral body that he's ill disposed towards, I'm sure. So that's another area of potential friction.
But that's a bit of a conundrum if we're talking about BRICS, because Donald Trump does have alignment with global powers like Russia and China. So that might play favorably or not.
Yeah, I know that argument. So it was quite interesting that when I had an interview with Ibrahim Rasool, who's just yesterday been fully credentialed as our ambassador to the U.S., and he said, oh, well, on Russia, we are in considerable alignment because both South Africa and Trump are very skeptical about NATO and think that NATO overstepped the mark by pushing up its membership to the, you know, boundaries of Russia. I think that's an argument you can overplay, though. It's been suggested to me because, yeah, he might have his own particular views on Russia, but there's still quite a strong feeling in Congress, I think, that is still sympathetic to Ukraine. It may not be sympathetic enough to continue with, you know, huge U.S. arms supplies to Ukraine, but it might be enough not to favor a South Africa position on Russia.
And Peter, you also write about climate change being a low priority for the Trump administration. Do you think this is going to impact any on our efforts to transition to a greener economy? And again, it all comes down, I imagine, to international funding.
Yeah, so there's a strong suspicion that the U.S. will pull out of the JETP program, you know, the Just Transition, the Environmental Energy Transition program, where U.S. and other Western countries put money into helping South Africa do that, to transition away from coal without hurting, you know, coal communities and coal workers. But that in itself would not be a major setback, because it doesn't amount to a huge, I mean, it's probably a billion dollars maybe, which is, you know, not chicken feed, but, you know, in the greater scheme of things, not so much. I think it's a broader impact of Trump policies on climate change that are more of greater concern for.
So, Peter, just finally then, I imagine it all comes down to prudent risk management. And given Trump's unpredictability, are there contingencies then that government and businesses should be preparing for in terms of trade and diplomatic relations? In other words, very simply, is there anything we can do?
Yeah, you know, again, in that interview, Ibrahim Rasool was saying we should sort of lower the volume on our megaphone, as he put it, on Gaza. I think there's probably some wisdom in trying to plan around doing without a goer, you know? I mean, it's an important program, and it's been significant for certain industries in particular, like autos, fruit and nuts and so on. But there would be, everyone would be wise to start thinking of alternative markets, I think.
I'm going to leave it there. Peter Fabricius, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, there's a new study that is highlighting the alarming health impacts of the overconsumption of sugary drinks, and that would include, obviously, rising rates of obesity and diabetes. I want to unpack the findings of this in a little more detail and explore some solutions and also look at the impact of sugar on the South African economy. I'm in conversation now with Dr. Patrick Ngasa Biochi from the University of Pretoria's Diabetes Research Centre. Doctor, very warm welcome. Let's start with the key findings of the study on sugary drinks and the health impact on South Africa. Fairly dire from what I've been able to discern.
Indeed, Jeremy. The study that was published on Nature, which is quite a reputable publication internationally, have shown that there is quite a high rate of diabetes related to consumptions of sugary drinks. And indeed, they've assessed data from 2 points in time, and they found that there has been an increase over time, not only globally, but also in South Africa.
And that almost runs against conventional wisdom. It does beg the question, does it not, as to why drinks like this still remain popular despite the well-documented health risks and those outlined in this particular study?
Yeah, unfortunately, we have now to mention the commercial determinants of health, which is the power of industry in terms of marketing, in terms of manipulating the way we live, the way we eat, the way we exercise. So there is a big machinery. I don't want to mention any company, but we all know the ones that are usually culprit in these kind of circumstances. They put a lot of money marketing for those products. And once they grab the individual from a young age, as we know, our kids are already drinking those drinks, it becomes difficult to disconnect and to change those habits.
Is this also, in your opinion, a failure of regulation?
Yeah, definitely. When we are confronted with situations whereby there's a whole industry driving these poor healthy habits, we need to counterbalance it with not only policies, but regulations, and also obviously monitoring those policies. So indeed, we think the government could do more to protect the lives of the people in South Africa.
But inevitably, there is going to be a lot of inactivity as far as that is concerned, given the amount of money that the industry contributes to the fiscus.
Indeed, indeed. Like you can see from the background around the sugar tax, there was a lot of lobbying from not only the sugar industry, but also those companies to not have a tax as aggressive as the healthcare advocates wanted. So as a result, although the tax that is actually in place is producing good results, we could still do more, in Mexico and elsewhere, where they have managed to really drastically change the consumptions of those drinks in their countries.
To what extent so far then, and let's talk about that sugar tax, has it impacted measurably, if one can work that out? Initially, it was introduced to curb consumption. Your suggestion is that it's doing a good job, but obviously not enough.
Yes, that's how we can summarize it. The early research is showing that we might have managed to curb by half the consumption of sugary drinks in South Africa after implementing the tax. But as you can see from the statistic around the prevalence of diabetes, we are still experiencing new cases. As you said in your introduction, we have a lot of obesity. Yes, we're not going to blame all on the sugary drinks, but it's part of the ecosystem and the environment. So we think that by being more aggressive on the sugar tax, we could do more in terms of preventing more cases of diabetes down the line.
What do you mean by being more aggressive on the sugar tax?
By increasing the tax, that's basically what the health advocates are asking for. I believe the government was quite conservative there were some fear-mongering about losing of jobs and stuff like that. But we believe that the tax can be increased in order to make sure that people stay away from those drinks, are discouraged by the pricing of those products, and therefore will maybe be guided towards other options. But yes, it shouldn't be isolated. We should do a lot of education in the countries, from the schools to the working adults to everybody. There should be a lot of sensibilization around why we need to adopt healthy lifestyles and healthy diets.
You make a compelling point, but it's also difficult, surely, for policymakers who've got to strike a balance between supporting local beverage industries on the one hand and prioritizing, as you're suggesting, public health.
Yes, it's a challenge, but we need to look at it differently. For example, we had the same long debates when we wanted to introduce the tobacco policies in South Africa. I'm sure you remember the industry were talking about loss of job, a lot of loss for the economy in South Africa, but not of that materialized. On the contrary, you're having healthy populations. People will be contributing to society longer and will be healthy longer, and obviously will be making a lot of savings in terms of healthcare. So those things tend to balance each other. And I think in all time, public health should be prioritized, because what would be good for us to have a population of sick people but still have a, in quotes, strong economy?
And I think you make a very important point in that respect, but I wonder to what extent it's been quantified. Has any work been done on the economic impact of sugar drink consumption on the healthcare system more generally?
I'm not aware of any, but by proxy, we will see that the impact of diabetes, since the paper made the point that the challenge is having type 2 diabetes from the consumption of those drinks, the impact of type 2 diabetes of an economy, it's very big. You can see the example in the United States, where you have a lot of obesity, a lot of diabetes, and they are putting a lot of money into preventing the complication from diabetes. In South Africa, we are very far from it. The number of deaths is quite high. Diabetes is now the number one cause of death in the country. But if we are to quantify, I'm sure I've seen a study recently, actually last year or so, whereby they say almost 12 billion of the budget is expected to be spent in preventing complications from diabetes, in solving or curing complications from diabetes. So you can see already there are some signs of a big impact on the economy of the country and obviously on the government budget.
Well, a stark warning certainly being sounded there. Dr. Patrick Ngasa Piochi from the University of Pretoria's Diabetes Research Centre, thank you very much for talking to me. And on Tuesday, the 14th of January, that is our program for today. We're back tomorrow with another 30 minutes looking at issues driving South Africa's business, political and social environment. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.